coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. Hello, hello. Welcome back to a live Chris Jordan, at least for the next couple minutes. We do have a pre-recorded guest at the top of the show, our good friend Michael Cargill, owner of Central Texas Gunworks, is coming on the show in a pre-recorded fashion. He was actively in D.C. today, talking to them about regulations, things like that, what we can do for teachers, schools, in the wake of this horrible, horrible tragedy of the Uvalde Elementary School shooting, literally on the heels of the end of the Texas school year. Chris Jordan, your host here, folks, coming to you from Austin, Texas. We will be getting into that tragedy, what we can do to help secure our schools. What we can do is our part, not only as parents, but as citizens, what we can petition for with our local and state governments, what we can do to help the cause and enable these teachers in the classrooms instead of hobbling them. And we are not even talking about arming teachers, folks. That is not the topic of discussion tonight, nor is the typical rhetoric of red versus blue and gun control. We are literally talking about real-world solutions and what we can do to help keep our schools and our classrooms in America safer. We will be getting into that with our good friend Michael Cargill here in just a moment. I spoke with him just a few hours ago and recorded this little segment. And then whenever we come back from him, we will be joined by Mike Turber as well as Miguel. Miguel is a security expert, to say the least. He has worked in the world of exfiltration, in the world of human trafficking exfiltration, things like that, and security otherwise, as well as Michael Turber. He has worked in that realm as well. So we will be continuing that topic with them. And then after commercial break, bringing on Robert Lindsay Milne to talk about what it is to be a psychic intuitive and to live in the world of today as a psychic intuitive. How hard is it? What is it? How can you recognize these skill sets within yourself and how can you hone them? We will be getting into that and so much more this evening. First, of course, our news of the week, brought to you by the Facebook themselves. Speaking of Facebook, you may notice an odd little picture up in the corner from me this week. That is my avatar. That's right. I actively have an avatar, folks. And if you are a social media user out there and you don't have an avatar, I highly recommend you do. I got hacked this last week. Believe it or not, it happens, especially on the heels of 5,000 followers on our page, over 1,000 members of our group now. So we become a target because of stuff like that. And though we're brought to you on Facebook tonight, we'll see for how long. We'll see if it works out. I'm coming to you live through my avatar because my typical page won't let me. It also won't let me go live to YouTube. So we've apparently been shaking up a couple things. But let's stop on by and check out the news of the week out of thesun.com. Russia threatens to wipe out the entire U.S. with just 4 Satan II missiles. Out of Mirror UK, man sets himself on fire at tourist spot and onlookers take selfies as he burns. That is some very disturbing content, folks. I'm just here to warn you. Out of USA Today, 70 million children and human trafficking victim, or 7 missing children and human trafficking victims recovered in 3-week Texas operation, officials say. We really need to have Chung Kim on to talk about that kind of stuff here soon. Out of CBS News, Texas police, teacher closed, propped open door before attack. And this is really important, folks, because it's been said numerous times. As a matter of fact, retraction from my statement coming up with Michael Cargill, because this is so new. That came, this article out of CBS News, saying that the teacher that propped open the door before the attack, which has been quoted and quoted and quoted, and even quoted by yours truly here in a few minutes, as you will hear, not only did she unprop the door before the attack and closed it, but ends up the door never locked in the first place. The lock on the door was broken, so it wouldn't matter if she propped it open or not. We have unsecured doors at these facilities. So we're going to be getting into that so much more. Thank you so much, Facebook, for the news of the week. Thank you so much to our sponsors, especially the amazing WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is your source for high-speed internet for your entire family, whether you're at home, whether you're on the go. Our website live feeds have been brought to you by WebWorks Wireless since they have begun. And I'm here to tell you, folks, it is unlimited. We have yet to be throttled. More than 20 gigs a month I put up with this service. Stop on by, check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. Our second sponsor, Secret to Everything, SecretToEverything.com, our good friend, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. Stop on by and check her out. She is your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion. While you're there, stop on by, check out CuriousRealm.com. That is where we have everything listed, including our upcoming events. We will be coming to you in just a couple weeks live from the Falk Monster Festival with our good friends Craig Woolheater, Daniel Allen Jones, a whole bunch of cryptozoologists out there. I cannot wait to be out at the Falk Monster Festival. In addition to that, we will be coming to you in July from the MUFON Symposium in Denver. So just a few live events coming up that we are official sponsors at, that we will be bringing you boots on the ground coverage like we did with the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Festival. I'm going to go ahead and play this clip now while I get connected with Mike Turber for the second part of our first part of the show. But here is my conversation earlier with Michael Cargill. Let's go ahead and check that out. In response to the recent shooting in Uvalde, I thought it was proper for us to bring on firearm expert Michael Cargill. He also teaches security, has years of experience in the world of gun law, what it is to carry a firearm, what it is to be an armed individual, as well as to serve our country. Welcome back to the show, Michael Cargill. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, like I told you in our pre-show text back and forth, my friend, I don't want to go down rabbit holes that typically get gone down as far as like what's an assault rifle, what's not an assault rifle, things like that. But what I do want to get into is the gun laws regarding schools, the gun laws regarding gun safe zones, the gun laws regarding even security officers on site, because not a lot of people realize that, constitutional sheriffs are one thing, but your average police department does not have a compunction by law to defend you with their firearm. So let's start getting into some of these strange things that have kind of led to literally the police department stymieing outside for 77 minutes, waiting for backup, waiting for literally permission to go in and handle business in this horrible, horrible situation that happened in our home state here in Texas, right down the road from us in Uvalde.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a sad situation, you know, these kids had to go through something like that and experience something like that. And there are things that we can do, and we have addressed these issues. And like you said before, you know, let's talk about that the Supreme Court has a decision, and that decision said that police have no duty to protect you, only general duty to enforce the law. That's the Supreme Court precedent. That is a case. And so here we are, you know, we have Columbine, you had the Columbine shooting. We found out then during that shooting that police should not wait until SWAT arrives. They should not wait for reinforcements. They have the tools. They have the body armor. They have the firepower. They have the ammunition. They have the, the backup weapons to stop a active shooter. And they should, as 2, 3, 4 members of the police department arrive, no matter what department they're from, you're supposed to go in. You're supposed to eliminate the threat. You're supposed to step over bodies. It doesn't matter who's injured, you know, who's asking for help. You go past them. You step over the injured. You stop that threat. Once that threat has been neutralized, then you start attending to the wounded. And you do that immediately. There's no waiting for SWAT or anything like that. We found out in 2018, during the Santa Fe High School shooting in Texas, that we need to secure the doors. They said doors and entrances were a problem. So we said, hey, you know what we're going to do is let's eliminate all the doors. Let's make sure they're all locked. This was a huge, huge issue in 2018 about all the doors. Here on this case right here, you had a teacher propping a door open because the teacher apparently wanted to load their vehicle up because of the end. It was close to the end of the school year, with their, supplies and tools and stuff. So complacency, gets us as well. Yeah. And then, so you have an issue with the police officer not, going in when they should. They have all the equipment, all the body armor. You have teacher, whoever this is, propping a door open. And then you have parenting is going to be an issue. This kid has he had a mother and a father. And this is where the Republicans, I'm sorry, when I say this, I'm not saying this because I'm representing any organization. Nope. I'm saying this personally for Michael Cargill. Michael Cargill is saying this, no organization that I represent or anything like that. And that is, Republicans have got to decide on where they're going to lie when it comes to abortion. Because if you're going to force these parents to have these kids and that they don't want, that can possibly become school shooters, this is going to be something that we have to deal with.
Well, and that has been the conversation that I have been having over the last many days with people, is that we have a lot of issues in America. And some parts of gun control may be one of those. But what we have a much larger issue with, Michael, is healthcare, family healthcare, mental healthcare, being able to get people the mental healthcare that they need without stigma. And that even comes to our vets coming on the heels of Memorial Day, things like that. The greater majority of homeless are vets because of this situation. And it literally is one of the worst things going on in our society in America that we turn a blind eye to constantly. And the question that we have to ask ourselves as far as motivation here is, why is it that an 18-year-old turns to this as his solution? Why is it also that apparently for weeks he had been posting things on social media to next to no compunction from the police department? He had made numerous threats apparently. Here we go. Here it is from the Texas Tribune, talking about, I witnessed him harass girls and threaten them with sexual assault, like rape and kidnapping, said the teen. It was not a single occurrence. It was frequent. This was from a 16-year-old that he was on Yobo with, or Yubo. Yubo is the social media platform. That's a kid from Austin who testified to that.
And my question is, did anybody report him? Did this kid report them?
Yes.
Did his, sibling, anyone else report them? And then if they did, then that means law enforcement failed. They didn't do their job.
Yeah.
The parents didn't do their job. There's no way that a person's going to wake up one day and decide to do something this.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Yeah. This is something that you have plotted, you have planned, you have just sadly enough, just like anybody who is committed in their mind that they are going to commit suicide, they are resolved.
The same type of person would actually jump in a vehicle, steal a car, hop a curb, and try to run over people, that are at a festival. The same person will do the same thing. Same person goes and pushes a person in front of a subway.
Yeah.
The same person pushes a person in front of a bus. That evil that we're talking about. Well, it doesn't matter what the tool is. You can't ban buses. You can't ban cars. You can't ban any of the tools. We need to address what the issue is, and that is evil.
Yes, absolutely. And to carry that one further, Michael, further on from that, yes, he and his friends, this 16-year-old from Austin and his friends, reported Ramos's account to Yubo for bullying and other infractions dozens of times. They never heard back, he said, and their account remained active. So, his account had been reported by numerous people numerous times saying, like, hey, he is threatening physical violence to people. He is threatening violent actions like rape and other things. And nothing happened. And it's kind of sad to know. It goes on from some of the ladies this article where they just call it the status quo of misogyny on the internet. And that's horrible to hear from teenage girls that, like, this is what they're used to. I've seen all kinds of meme images about kids hunkered underneath desks with active shooter drills. I know my parents, I know your parents grew up in the age of duck and cover. And that was for nuclear annihilation, like duck under your seat. The question that has come into my mind, Michael, and I know the main reason I wanted to have you on was because we had discussed the concept before of an optional day of training within, because most school districts, teachers spend a week to 2 weeks of in-service a year. And what would it take for us to be able to have an optional day of training for teachers? Because, of course, there's the FBI video that was released a few years ago, things like that after Parkland, other such things. But that's literally like barricade your door, grab a stapler and throw it at them. The question is, do you know how to properly throw that stapler? Do you know how to properly barricade your door?
It's really the basics. It's the basics of locking the doors, because a lot of your schools have spent money on reinforcing the glass. Mm-hmm. Actually, after the high school shooting that happened in 2018, part of that was we went to the gun range and we tested glass for schools, for your preschools, middle schools, elementary schools, and middle schools and high schools. And the glass, the way this glass was designed was, for a teacher would be able to shoot out the front door, out the glass, but the shooter could not shoot in the school. Mm. It actually would ricochet and go back and hit the shooter. So that's the way this glass was actually designed. And the tools are there. Stuff just needs to be implemented. We need to get this installed. We need to make sure that the teachers are not complacent and that you're right. They need to continue. They need to do training. It should be quarterly, for the teachers. Because their job is to protect the babies. Here we are. We have police officers at high schools. Instead of using them as security, we're using them as a disciplinary tool. We have police officers at middle schools. Instead of using them as security, we use them as a disciplinary, tool. And then guess what? The elementary school, there are no resources of the elementary school because we put police officers at schools for using them for discipline, not security. And they need to be at the elementary school because that's where the babies are unprotected.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, that brings us right back to the point of whether or not the officer in place can actively even use his firearm.
Hmm.
And
it always goes back to training, and also the officer who is assigned to that school should have the keys of every single door, and they should know the ins and outs of that school. It shouldn't be a doubt of waiting for a janitor, going and looking for a janitor.
Yeah.
The police officer, that resource officer, should have the keys to get access to whatever room, whatever building in that school.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it really is about enabling and not hobbling our teachers. And once again, I am not. I know we've had the conversation on my previous incarnation of this show, Michael. I'm not a fan of our mall teachers. I'm not a fan of our mall citizens. I don't think all citizens are responsible enough.
Right. And not everyone should have a gun.
Yeah.
You know, that's first of all.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone should have one. Not everyone wants one. And so, but you need to know how to defend yourself. You need to know how to use the security tools that we have out there so that way we can stop these monsters when they slip through the system.
That's right.
This guy slipped through the system. He was, you know, he's evil. And the only way you can stop evil is kill it, you know, and that's it. You know, and somehow he slipped through.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not to say that we don't. Now, granted, I think that some gun laws could have a little bit more teeth. I think that they could probably be implemented a little bit more regularly.
We need some district attorneys to do their job.
Yes.
Some DAs.
Yes.
You know, they're not prosecuting the people that are repeat offenders. We see that in Austin, Texas all the time. Where, you know, in the guy that did the mass shooting in Austin did a previous shooting in Killeen, Texas. And the DA in Killeen did nothing, and he ended up doing another shooting.
Yeah.
You know, so we see this time and time again. It's always the same people that are repeat offenders committing the most heinous crimes in our community.
And ladies and gentlemen, please remember, this is coming to you from a firearms trainer and a firearms dealer. Right now, this is not your average person telling you this. And it would be pretty rare that you would hear most gun store owners, Michael, say that everybody doesn't need to own a firearm.
No, they don't.
That's absolutely not. I love about you. You are one of the most common sense people, and the work that you do out there. Yes. With the log cabin Republicans, things like that. I love it. I love the fact that you are out there. You are involved in the community. You actively go to the news, go to the press. You call out the DAs here in Austin.
I'm not trying to protect a special interest group.
No.
I'm not trying to protect the organization. You ask me a question, I'm going to tell you from the heart.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you that honest answer on how I feel and how I think we need to solve the problem.
Well, and that's exactly why I wanted to have you on today, Michael, because you are not somebody that toes a line when it comes to these things. You are somebody who comes at it with nothing but heart, soul, as somebody who fought for our nation, as somebody who spent their time serving our nation and still does so in the fact of finding those responsible citizens and properly teaching them how to use their firearm, and not just use their firearm, but to defend themselves without it.
Right.
And once again, that's probably the most important thing. I'll gladly work with you whenever you get back to find like a local Krav Maga place anywhere. I challenge any of you out there that teach these skills. Please reach out to your local school districts. Offer your services for free, like small classes of 10 teachers, optional training, for free. Please, God. Put it out there, folks. Let's help change these people, because I can tell you, as someone who has spent time in a classroom, you go through some security checks, things like that, but it's a wave and a howdy aside from maybe a badge that locks a door.
And there are people out there that want to do this.
Look at the
mother who drove 40 miles in Uvalde, who drove 40 miles, who was in a field working, heard that there was a shooting, drove to the school, got handcuffed, detained by the police. They released her from handcuffs. She broke free, went into the school unarmed, grabbed her two kids and pulled them out while the police were waiting outside.
Yeah.
That there, the hero.
Yeah.
That is a hero.
Yeah. Amen, man.
That's a mama bear.
That is a red tape wearer.
You want to stop these shooters? You arm the mama bears out there. Let me tell you.
And, you know, I just got tingles with you saying that because, yeah, absolutely. I've got a mama bear out in the other room right now with my little one, and we've had talks with him, you know, and it's not easy trying to talk to a 5-year old about something like this, about something where if you see your teacher scared, you need to try to help them, you know, that kind of stuff. And you need to be safe. You need to hide. You need to hide well. Because yeah, it once again, 77 minutes, people. We have to remember that 77 minutes it took for the police to go in. Now, granted, other people went in, did things, stuff like that, but they stymied for 77 minutes. You can call 911 all day. The question is, until then, if you're the first on scene, you are the first responder. What are you going to do?
You had elementary school kids in the classroom, 112 and 113, I'm sorry, 112, 111, yeah, that were calling 911 and begging, please come and save us. I hear the police outside. You're outside our classroom. Please come and save us. Call them multiple times, not one time, not a second time, not a third time, not a fourth time, not a fifth time, multiple times. Yeah. So please come and save us. We hear you outside. Please, begging. Yeah. They had the body armor. They had the guns. They had the ammunition. And those babies were unprotected against a monster with an AR. And they did nothing.
Yeah. And, you know, before we let you go, Michael, where can people go to find their local if they are within Austin here with us? Who can they talk to locally, school board wise, things like that? I know that you're very involved with such things. Yeah, where is there a national institution that we can go to about this kind of stuff? And do we need to start one?
Yeah, I got so frustrated this weekend that I stopped everything that I was doing. I jumped on a plane and drove to Washington, D.C. because I wanted my elected officials to hear from me and to see my face and let me know I'm serious. You know, I'm only here for a couple of hours. I'm in Washington, D.C. right now.
Yep.
And I'm letting them know, you know, I'm serious about this. You know, the things that we need to do and not going back and forth between the Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, whatever. You know, we need to look at the issue and solve the actual problem and address the problems and some of the leaks that we have. Or, because if we don't, then we're going to lose some of the rights that we enjoy today. And I don't want to lose any of those rights. I enjoy those.
Yeah.
You can go to your city council. You can talk to your independent school district. Go to your school board. Go to the school board meetings. Go to city council meetings and let them know. That is where change will happen. Because they're hearing from the small group of crazy people, and they're not hearing from those people that are, you know, that are intelligent and can come with solutions and, you know, and come with solving some of these problems that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Perfectly put, Michael. We really do need to raise the voice of the middle and of the rational right now. And that is what needs to be amplified, not the extremes either way, you know, because those are typically what get amplified. And those are the voices of the politic. Like you said, those are the ones that are screaming red and blue. And right now we need as purple as we can get.
Right. Because one thing we cannot do is we cannot regulate crazy, but what we can do is eliminate and kill crazy.
Yes, absolutely. And the last thing that you ever want to do is politicize death. So, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time on what I know is a busy day for you. You're literally pulled over on the side of the road on your way to the airport to come back. So thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. Let everybody know where they can find you, where they can go locally here in the Austin area for training, everything else, my friend.
Absolutely. It's CentralTexasGunWorks.com, on Facebook, on Twitter, Syntex Guns, our website, CentralTexasGunWorks.com. Give us a call, 512-731-3585.
Thank you so much again. And we will be right back, folks, with our good friend Michael Turber, a security professional, as well as special guest with him to discuss this topic and security protocols.
Look at that.
We are back. And I supposedly have Mike Turber. Let's see here. Mike, are you there?
I am here, if you can hear me.
Welcome back. Alan, Michelle, thank you so much for the amazing conversation in our Facebook feed. So glad to see that avatars work, Michael. my avatar is streaming for us tonight. So welcome back to the show. I'm so sorry that it is under, once again, these horrible, horrible circumstances. You are one of the people that we bring on whenever we have mass shootings, of course, because of your extensive relationship to the Route 91 shooting and other investigations. So
absolutely.
Welcome back.
And that's how we met. That is how we met.
Yeah. So. Yeah, precisely. And I always love hearing you weigh in on things like this because of your background in exfiltration and investigation and how things like this slip through the cracks. Like we talked about with Michael Cargill a minute ago, this young gentleman, Salvador, had numerous cases on Yubo where he had made threatening remarks, where he had made threats of violence toward women, all kinds of things, to no avail,
And you have to wonder where exactly he was on the radar. You know, obviously he wasn't apparently on the correct radar or any radar probably for that matter, but there's a certain point where you have to wonder if some of these more rural areas, even some of the cities, I mean, basically anywhere, we have a problem in this country. Obviously, we have a problem with mass shootings. It needs to be addressed. Obviously, what we're doing now is not working. And it seems that it's just we're passe to it now. I mean, these things happen almost every day in one capacity or another. I do think the actual definition of mass shooting probably needs to be tweaked a little bit or changed slightly so it makes more sense. But and overall, you know, there's a lot of Band-Aid action going on. Well, we're Monday quarterbacking. We're able to say, well, we should have done this or whatever. Well, we shouldn't have to say we should have done anything. We should do those things.
Yes.
There's, you know, and the thing is, remember when we were in school and we had that piece of wood and metal that we used to climb under? And it would protect us from a nuclear explosion for some reason. Okay, so there was active shooter training for police officers. We need active shooter training in the school, just like we did back during the Cold War when we all climbed underneath the desk and we did these things. That should be going on. I don't see it going on. It may be going on in certain areas, but that is not something that's across the board. I think that probably until this, I don't want to call it a crisis. I don't want to give it a name or anything like that, but for the lack of a better term, it is a crisis. This is something that's affecting us tremendously. And it's not getting better. It seems to be getting worse.
Yeah. Now, granted, I mean, active shooter drills do go on. As a matter of fact, they had an active shooter drill all of 2 weeks before this.
Yeah.
In Uvalde, all of 2 weeks prior, there was an active shooter drill. The problem is, once again, as we discussed with Michael Cargill, that not for a long, long time has it been the practice of the FBI to wait for further instructions. You pursue heavily, and
exactly.
You know, like Alan Dion is saying, they have lockdowns, not active shooter drills in Canada.
Right.
things like that. And yeah, like we should have more deterrent systems.
Agreed. And the person that created the active shooter program inside the FBI, that's Catherine Schwitt. And she was an agent. I think she retired probably 2017. And when she created that program, obviously it was something that was looked at from Sandy Hook, which I know you're extremely familiar with.
Yes.
And whatnot. And, you know, we do have on the call, I just noticed he's on the call with me now. We have Special Agent Miguel Saez. And Miguel, are you on? Let me see if I can hear you here.
Yeah, I'm on here.
Okay, can you hear him?
Yes, I can. Welcome, Miguel.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Miguel, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we can stretch this into some of the proactive ways to thwart what's going on.
Yeah, of course. So I'm retired military, about 20 years retired Army Special Operations Forces, and it took time, wound up getting out, and I got into the civilian sector, into the intelligence community. And through doing that, I wound up working in special task forces, fugitive recovery programs. I did work with Mr. Kerber here and had the opportunity to in 2021 in Afghanistan, working with multiple people, multiple agencies, military branches, and helping out American citizens, U.S. Embassy staff, and interpreters, and as well as other special operations forces currently serving. So as far as experience, you know, I have 20 years in the military special operations forces through Delta, and going through that is going into the federal sector at currently where I'm at now. And that's a little bit about me in a nutshell.
Well, welcome to the program. I greatly appreciate you being able to join our discussion this evening. For the same reason that I like having someone like Mike on, when Mike brought up the fact that you might be able to join us, I was like, I would absolutely love to have him part of this conversation. Because one of the things I have posed for years, Miguel, is a one-day optional training. Typically, most school district teachers go through like a week to 2 weeks of in-service a year. And I think that there should be an optional day of training where, you know, the same way that police learn unarmed combat techniques to be able to disarm an assailant, things like that. Yeah. You know, these same techniques should be taught to our teachers, or at least teachers that are willing to learn.
And I have taught CQC my entire adult life. And one of the things that I've noticed in doing that is that a lot of people don't understand that you can learn something in a very short period of time. And I mean, within 30 minutes. That will save your life and those that you love. A lot of people kind of get into the program of, oh my God, my kid's got to go to, you know, to martial arts class for 3 years before they can even, you know, feel confident in their skills. No, that's not the case. Any adult that wants to take a close quarter combat CQC course can do so in such a way that they can learn in less than an hour, just three or four techniques. That's all they need to do. You don't need to know every single thing that like Miguel is trained to do and myself is trained to do. Just a few things. And the key thing is there's three things you do during an active shooting. You can run, you can hide, or you can fight. And that's in the FBI training. And that's basically on the end of the person that's in the situation. They run, they hide, or they fight. That's the three choices that you really have. And in this case, that's exactly what we see happen. But there's another scenario that's involved here. There's so many mistakes that we see this, and this isn't the first time. I mean, we've gone through this before, Chris, and where we've looked back and you see something, but this one has a lot of hints of, say, the Las Vegas shooting, where you had officers that were on the scene. They were innocent in the situation where they could have affected a change. They could have affected an end to this situation, and it didn't happen. We know partly what the reason is they're claiming that it was considered to be a barricade situation. When that determination is made, whatever process was put into place to get to the determination that it possibly was a barricade situation, that needs to be looked at very closely, because obviously that was a huge mistake here.
Yeah,
Miguel. What do you see as you know? You've analyzed this even more so than I have. What are your thoughts?
Correct. Yeah, and as an ongoing investigation, you know, the it's very fluid, and there's so many things going on right now. And as we look in the inside of what happened in Uvalde, Texas, in the school, and we're looking at the ultra sophisticated dynamics of local police and county sheriff, DEA, FBI, Border Patrol, BORTEC, everyone that was on scene there, including FBI. It was a very didactic situation. And at the same time, as someone who has been in an active shooter situation multiple times, like myself and yourself, Mike, I know for a fact, as a resident to where I currently live, that peace officers here in active shooter situations, they do train at the local schools. They do train the teachers here, and it is run, hide, and fight. And unfortunately, there is a big crux of miscommunication, what we're finding out through this investigation here. And it was through this, and I don't know if that's because of radio communication, you know, someone's on different radio comms and different channels, if, you know, we're not able to, pass through, or through mutual aid or whatnot. But what I do know is, that the situation is very unfortunate, that the officers where I live would have, in fact, have breached into that school, engaged the shooter, and it all means necessary, even at the cost of their own lives. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to look at the demographical area and see the situation for is what it is. So I don't, as we're investigating Uvalde, Texas, you know, you're looking at the size in the town of Uvalde, Texas. Are they the size of Austin? Are they the size of Dallas? Do they have the appropriate instructors to train them, or do they train them train themselves by in-house training, or do they contract out to former special operations SWAT team members or Green Berets to come in and train them? And unfortunately, what we had was a big breakdown of communication. A big breakdown of what could have been prevented, and what now is ultimately our Department of Justice. We're leading a full-fledged investigation into all of the agencies there for all the homicides. You know, and technically they are considered all these children are homicide victims. Yeah. When someone is killed in a tragic situation, you know, that is considered a homicide. And so you have to have a homicide detective or someone that's in a homicide bureau or division come down and take a look at all this and take a look at all the information that's going on. And with the information that we've collected and put together, it's just, there's so many things And to be blunt and true to everyone is that so many people did not do what they were supposed to do.
Yes.
And they're lying. And so they're covering up for themselves. And unfortunately, yeah, within the Department of Justice, now it is the process to undo all of those lies and find the truth.
Yeah.
To what really happened.
And I am actively bringing up the ABC News Go article that came out just a little while ago. This was 527. Uvalde Police School District no longer cooperating with Texas probe of shooting, according to sources. That is how far
they're
gonna
internalize.
They are putting up the walls of defense. They are compartmentalizing. That is proof of the fact of there was full on. I mean, I was trying to find the image, but on Twitter, I want to say it was. And if any of you guys out there can find it, please come share it to the Curious Realm group. But last year, there was a Texas grant that went to the Uvalde Police Department, and all 50 full-time members of the Uvalde mm-hmm. Police Department were granted level 4 body armor.
Right.
Yeah. All 50 of them. And they're a part-time yep. SWAT team. So, correct. Like, they all had the body armor. They just stood out. Like, it ended up being two Border Patrol agents that walked in with shields and handled right. up on things.
Remember the situation in Vegas where we had Cordell Hendricks, and yes. where he froze on the 31st floor, and him freezing caused the three people that were with him, which yes. were, you know, two were Mandalay Bay and him and his training. And he was a training officer. He was not just an officer going up to the room, just your standard guy. This is the guy that trains the other officers, and he froze. So we understand that humans are human, and I'm not trying to absolutely. Be dehumanizing, but people do freeze. And what happens in this scenario, how did you have 19 people freeze? That's a problem. That's a huge problem.
Not necessarily freeze, but freeze to the point that they were able to have a meeting.
Right. They were able to have a meeting, discuss yeah. things, and they're basically, the kids can hear this. I mean, they're hearing the cops are right outside, and they're asking the person at dispatch, 911, why aren't they coming?
Why are they coming?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that just breaks my heart, you know, to hear that. And these are the scenarios where we have to look at this and go, okay, whatever this decision process, wherever it comes from, it doesn't matter. It's obviously a breakdown in training. And as far as any organization, you know, trying to create communications, you know, sometimes they go in, you know, the SWAT team sets up their comm links and they go to TAC 1, TAC 2, blah, all this other crap. That's completely out of it. If you have a mass shooter, active shooter in situation, and if he's no longer active, this is going to sound, you know, this is just me talking off the street level. It has nothing to do with my professional level. I don't care. I don't care if he stops shooting or not. You go in and get him.
Yeah.
you just do it. Because apparently if you see it as a situation where he's barricaded, okay, well, you still got to go get him eventually.
Yeah.
Just do whatever you can to do it. If you find out that he's, you know, booby trapped the whole hallway and all this other stuff, that I get, I understand. That's the legitimate fear, but it's how many times have we seen that? Zero. I haven't seen it in years where someone's gone in and wow, the guy's got this thing all booby trapped and all this stuff. So that's not a legitimate thing, but anyway, so you know, that's the way I view it on a personal street level. From a professional level, then yeah, there's a lot of things that need to be looked at and addressed, but this can't be a situation where, you know, we got to go back. We got to revise this, revise that. We have to do that. But this is an ongoing thing. You know, mass shootings have, you know, I guess since Sandy Hook is when we probably looked at them a lot harder than we ever did, because Sandy Hook was the game changer in this type of event. I think everybody can probably agree with that.
Sandy Hook was really the first time where it happened that it didn't happen from somebody internal to the community. Or someone on campus, something like that, where somebody totally from outside.
Right, and you see a radical shift in the mindset of the individual that's perpetrating this act. That individual is not your average individual. Obviously, I'm very, very much up to date on as far as Stephen Paddock is concerned. I'm probably the expert on him. But when it comes to the other shooters, there's a similar trait amongst them all. Once they've determined they're going to do this, there's very little that's going to change, and they are committed, and they seem to just they're going to follow through with it.
And
Mike,
Miguel, go ahead and take over, please.
Mike, you're very on track with that, and there is what you're talking about is very true. And what we're seeing is there's a lot of radicalization within members of the community in the United States on certain internet service providers and portals like Discord, YouTube, different platforms for people to connect. And actually, one of the interesting facts is that we're tracking and tracing down is that the shooter that at Uvalde, he was actually connected to some other people that we have some ongoing investigations too with that were active shooters just in the past week as well. And so it's not like a lone gunman theory. There actually is a connection and there what we're calling a grooming person that is connected to this. And so when we retract and go back down to the stand down order, we're looking at who gave down the stand down order and why did the teacher prop the door open during the lockdown. That, we're looking at those. And we're looking at the track records at certain things. But yeah,
there's an update on their door. There's an update on the door where now they're saying the door was closed. So
right, and it's kind of funny because all the information that me and my team receive on a daily basis, it changes every 5 minutes to 35 minutes. It changes. It's like the door's open. He had a hat on. A bullet went through his hat, but now the Border Patrol agent wasn't there, and there was no police ever engaging. Now the police were engaging. Now they weren't engaging.
Right.
So you see, I mean, there's so much miscommunication. Yeah. You just don't know what to believe.
And we know the timeline is going to change. It changes in all these events, and people have to understand that as more accurate information, and especially information that can be backed up with CCTV footage or audio analysis, which is what I did, those things are extremely helpful in narrowing down the timeline.
Correct.
Well, the one thing that will not change is his record on social media. Once again, Yubo, things like that that he was a part of. There was a young gentleman here in Austin that was interviewed that was a member of his social media circle. And he said that he'd made numerous threats of violence and rape toward women. Things like that. Now, Miguel, especially with your work in cult mentality, things like that, as Michael said a while ago, I myself have had numerous people in my life commit suicide, and a couple of them I had chance to talk to shortly before, and it did a lot to me for a long time, the fact that I didn't see it. And the thing is, once somebody has gone to that point and they have made that decision, they're comfortable with their decision. They have fully committed to this. So to them, it's everyday life now. What does it take for an 18-year-old like Salvador Roland Ramos to get to the point that violence against children is his go-to solution.
You know, there is a psychological profiling. There are sick individuals out there that will find younger versions of themselves. And what they do is they find those younger versions of themselves and they befriend them. And but in befriending them, you know, they wind up giving them things, buying them stuff, gifting them the world.
Yeah.
And through the course of their coercion, without them really knowing it, they are being trained and directed. And when you bring up I specialize in occults and occult mentalities.
Mm.
And so when you talk about like a cult, you look at back at like Jim Jones and some of the other cults like that, where you have someone that's very persuasive over someone else's own independent choices. And they're pretty much over their own mental capacity in everything they do, and to the point to where this person is very manipulative and mm-hmm. very controlling, and they don't have to be very forceful. And so, from what we've seen, and from the information and evidence I've seen and portrayed so far, is that, you know, this individual here, unfortunately was a victim, to a cult, like mentality of someone, you know, taking advantage of him. I'm not saying he's not guilty of anything. What I'm saying is that, you know, in his upbringing, something failed. And in that failure of his upbringing, and I'm not, you know, we're not here to demonize anyone or say what is right or wrong, but somewhere in his upbringing, something had failed really bad. And he was the victim of being a person that was, taken advantage of. And then, pretty much what you could technically call their brainwash, to a certain point. And with that, you know, like you said, you know, when somebody goes to that certain extreme, you know, you go to that end point where you say, you know, there's no coming back. You know, we call it the PNR, the point of no return. And when they come to that point of no return, it's at that time, sometimes they realize what has happened, what transpired. And then they know they can't go back, and they know they're in too deep. And so, and also within the Vegas shooting as well, I did have some background experience in that. There's a lot more to it than just, you know, what we see on TV or what the media is portraying. And, you know, and unfortunately, we can't say everything in an ongoing investigation because there's a lot of information that investigators and detectives have to put together. You know, we have to get inside of his head, you know, and figure out what's going on, get into his computers. You know, then we have to figure out, like, who is that person that, you know, how did he get that, you know, Ford F-250, that $90,000 truck? You know, where did he get all those weapons and all that ammunition in the back of that truck? You know, from my understanding, you know, this kid, he was an 18-year-old kid, you know, who could barely afford to buy a 1996 Honda Accord.
Yeah.
You know, so these are all factors we have to look into. You know, and I mean, Mike, I mean, what's your opinion on it?
Well, I think actually, Chris, if you notice that there's been some revealing that's happened here, and there's a aspect of the investigation that delves into some areas we probably can't discuss openly yet, but enough to allow people to know that there's some areas of this investigation that are being looked at that could include or can be alleged that this shooter was involved actively in some sort of online some online communications were happening to where he was groomed into doing what he's done. Now, going back a little bit, if everybody remembers back during the Osama bin Laden situation where ISIS was actually in, you know, recruiting people, they were doing that through video game systems, PlayStation and Xbox. And one of the things that the thing is how do you monitor all of that, especially when a lot of it's encrypted communications? And we obviously, Miguel and I know how that's done, but back then no one knew that this was going on or that that was actually an area that the government actually was monitoring. And so a lot of times we have to look at this like, wow, do I trade off another Patriot Act type situation to where I allow these freedoms and rights or whatever to kind of like meander because the greater good is at hand here or what have you. So this is conversation that you're having right now tonight that it's not known. And this is conversation that people will be talking about down the road, but your show tonight is having information that's just not generally known. And it's going to be the subject of topic here pretty quick, and it's going to bring that back up again. So this shooting has the aspects that you see in several other shootings mixed together. This person had an agenda. He had he was groomed. He was all these different things. You know, where did all this start? Who is actually behind all of this? Is this a larger issue? Miguel, I don't think we can tell the number of contacts that the actual number of people that or other shooters that are out there that are in this mix. I don't know. We know what the number is, but the number is alarming to say the least. That these people are able to communicate with each other, and some don't really know that they're going to be a shooter. They just are talking online and then eventually they get wrapped up into it. And then there's a switch that somehow goes off in the head and then they become that person. And it's something that we need to learn to identify. We need to learn to identify as parents, as teachers, as friends that, hey, my friend just flipped that switch that you guys were talking about. So the behavioral analysis unit, which I know Susan over there is, if Susan, if you're listening, by all means, call me after this show. I've got some questions for you, and I think Chris might want to talk to you as well. But that is a job where you have a special team that can piece together a way for the average citizen to be able, you know, because we always look towards law enforcement or look towards our doctors or psychiatrists or this or that. We always point blame. Well, the problem now is that this is not going away. So everyone needs to learn what are the indicators that my son, my daughter, we don't really have female mass shooters, but my son or my friend or my brother or my whatever has the indications or indicators of what may be indicative of a mass shooter. And that's where we need to get better a lot quicker.
I agree with you, Mike. And, you know, and being a parent myself and having two young children, it's even when my kids have their friends come over and stay the night and you get to see how they interact and, it's a blessing to have children, and at the same time it's very scary, you know, especially the work that we do. And I my children don't know what I do, and I keep that stuff very private because that's something maybe later in life they can understand. But as you're saying, as a parent, I have, and I also have a brother who's a school teacher, and You know, and I've been talking to him about this as well. And at his school over in Ohio, you know, they do practice, you know, active shooting trainings, and they have their local county sheriff come in and train them. And the reality is when I talked to him, when I talked to him about the tragically what happened, what had just passed was, is that the majority of the staff, including himself, was, is that, you know, they have something called a SIP, a shelter in place.
Yeah.
And they do their best, yes, to save the kids and shelter them in place instead of running through corridors and absolutely jumping out windows. And that's their main focus. And the last thing that they want to do is going out running through a field where someone with a rifle, yeah, you know, has the scope of the field. And, right, you know, and then you have, and that's an innocent victim that's going to go down right there. And so, you know, with what these teachers did, giving up their own lives, protecting these children with every ounce that they had left.
Yeah.
You know, I pray to God that, you know, and their families that, you know, they did the best they could that law enforcement unfortunately couldn't do for them. And they, yeah, did what they could for the children.
Absolutely.
What the others couldn't do for them. And that's very unfortunate.
And of course, yeah, once again, I am not a fan of arming all teachers. I'm not a fan of armed teachers in general. I'm sure not a fan of, and once again, any defense class, I would not want teachers skulking the hallways like Steven Seagal trying to find an armed assailant, you know, but yeah, should they get through the barricaded door? Should it come to the point of, well, now you've thrown the stapler or the dictionary and you've managed to hit him. What do you, right, do now? And yeah, I think that's where we need to be able to enable our teachers. That's where we need to at least be able, yeah, to give, right, an optional day of training. And hey, pay for that day of training, like pay them for going.
Yeah, you have to determine too, is this going to be a mandatory thing or a non-mandatory thing? Because there are some other aspects to this that I've noticed when I went in thinking that, okay, we're going to make this mandatory. Every one of you is going to learn how to do this. And what I teach is something that's very simple, but at the other end of the spectrum, I have to remember I'm teaching people how to break arms and how to kill people and or how to handle a situation. And I have to remember this is what actually is happening. And these people are going to be freaked out by this. So you have to do it in such a way that you train them to the point that they're comfortable with. And then maybe down the road, they can, you know, they can make the decision to go further or not. But I think each teacher needs to have at least an initial set of skills that needs to be part of the process of, look, you're going to be a teacher. You already have to go learn CPR training. You already have to go learn, you know, some basic, you know, first aid type training. This should be as mandatory as that is the way I see it. That each individual teacher has to take some sort of course that learns at least the basic end of it. I'm not saying that we're going to expect them to act as a, you know, like a military member would. I mean, we're not looking at that level of training, but at least so that they have the basic skills that they can feel somewhat confident that if the situation is in the room and it's, they're not like trying to figure out how to lock doors and put things in front of doors and what have you and hunker down in place, that the scenario has changed now that this person, oh, he's in the room. I didn't train for this. What do I do? You know, because there, yeah, are people that actually have to be trained to do almost anything. And it's, yeah, understandable.
Yeah, and Mike, I actually agree with you. And I think we are now at the turning point in our society to where this, Uvalde shooting may have been the migration of where the teachers and the superintendents and the school district, you know, over the United States, and maybe in Northern Canada itself, have to make that determination to, you know, do we need to upgrade our security? Do we need to have more school resource officers? Do we, you know, and I hate to ask this, you know, or I hate to put this out there, but do we need to arm our teachers or not? You know, that's, you know, I believe our teachers are there to teach. And it's very saddening to hear that, oh, Dad, you know, my teacher, Mr. Smith, carries a 45 Glock just like you. And that's just for an example. Well, and, you know, I don't want to hear that.
It doesn't
you know?
Have to be worn on the hip is the thing. And we had a, great kerfuffle here. We've had quite the conversation going on in our Facebook feed. Alan Dion, of course, mentioned the same thing mentioning, and that's the fact that, unfortunately, you can't force this kind of training on people.
No.
But would I be opposed to one out of every 20 teachers? Because I can guarantee you probably in the state of Texas, one out of every 20, one out of every 50 teachers probably has a concealed carry permit.
I would say that going forward, that this has to be looked at in several ways. One is you have to look at the human aspect of it, which is the training of the teacher, the training of the resource officers, the training of anyone that works on that campus, including the janitor. I mean, I would love for the janitor to come out with a mop and gone into full ninja mode or something. That would have been awesome. But, you know, we can't fully expect that. But the other end of the spectrum is the very design of the school themselves. I mean, we have to design these things going forward, and it's very unfortunate. But if you look at it, everyone is driven down the street while kids are going to school, and you see how many access points there are to be able to get on some of these campuses, which is going to be ridiculous to go back and change. It might be too much. It could be involved with certain types of fencing and things like that. But now we look like we're putting kids in miniature prisons. And
well,
that
they already
is,
look like miniature prisons. That's why they're designed by institutional architects.
Right, and even even these guys are
you know that.
Well, the thing though is that they're already being designed by institutional architects. Then it is not hard to retrofit these things for said.
No.
Like, hey, here's a 5-way point of entry that leads to one common place.
Once the bell rings,
it's in lockdown mode, and you're getting in through a bulletproof area, you know.
Yeah, or a three-level situation where you have your initial security, which is just the outer perimeter barrier, and then as you get closer into the core, it's going to get tougher and tougher, that was not the case.
I remember going to pick up my niece one day, and I wasn't even picking her up, actually. I was dropping something off to her at her high school in Katy here in Texas. And this was probably about 8-9 years ago, Mike and Miguel, where I went up. They took a picture of my license. They ran it through an immediate background check, same way that they do at a gun store. Took my thumbprints, put it through their system. This was all being done like through a little metal slide drawer, you know, bulletproof Lucite, everything else, locked doors that you couldn't get through until you passed through their security check and had their badge on.
And that's the exception rather than the norm. That's awesome.
Yeah. And this was 10 years ago. So it's one of those like, it's not that difficult. Like Michael Cargill said, we have this stuff and it's available. We just need to spend the money to do it. And at what point does that become a line item, man?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I can, some of the information we have seen on those line items that you're talking about is the questioning of where the money is being spent and where the money is being sent. And of course this is an open investigation, but you know, again, we'll just call example school A. So school A is a very private school, has all those features, and school B is a similar school to what has transpired, to where, you know, we had what transpired. But in school B, we are seeing that funding being spent on frivolous things and something in the government we call fraud, waste, and abuse. And within the money that's being spent, it's being spent on, you know, new work, construction work cars that are really realistically not needed. And, you know, money being spent to pay the superintendent an exponentially amount of more money. And, you know, it's within that fraud, waste, and abuse. And Mike, I know you're very familiar with that term. It's you know, having finances and I grew up in a small town in Wyoming, and so I understand that, you know, growing up in a small school district with federal funding, you know, you're given a pretty good amount of money.
There's some changes that can be done that are free. It costs nothing. And one of those that was brought up, and I'm not sure how it could necessarily be implemented in such a way, but if you're an at-home dad or an at-home mom, in that 1 hour or 2 hour window or whatever, where you can be the extra set of eyes on that campus. You don't have to be in with the kids. You know, you don't have to be an additional security risk. You can be the extra set of eyes. The school has 10 walkie-talkies. One of them goes to the person that's that person of the moment who is we have walking guards that help us walk across the street, right?
Absolutely.
So that happens. Yeah. So, you know, I guarantee you that the people that are listening to my voice right now, including Alan Dion up in Canada, would probably go, you know what? I would volunteer to hang out at the school right as they open or close or at any certain time that they want and just hang around there and just be an extra set of eyes. You don't have to like guard and patrol the place and be armed or anything. Just if that person knows that there's extra sets of eyes that are there, because that resource officer, from what I'm told, was not there or had just came back or whatever the narrative is now.
Well, and, you know, and so, once again, we have to remember that we've seen up here, you know, hire veterans as SROs. You have to remember that an SRO is not a sworn sheriff. A sworn sheriff has the actual constitutionally sworn duty to protect you with his life. An average police officer does not. They are basically the equivalent of a garbage man who can write tickets and can carry a gun.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are an employee under contract. That is how most PDs work in America. Sadly, folks.
They don't even have to follow the Good Samaritan law in some cases.
And as we saw, and this came up, this ruling came up time and time again when it was referenced that the SRO on campus at Parkland High School ran from the scene 20 feet away from the shooter, took off.
Yep.
He could not be prosecuted because a police officer does not have the obligation to sacrifice themselves or use their firearm in defense of the general public.
That's correct.
That's exactly an absolute fact. So neither does an SRO. And that's why there was a meeting of 100 cops sitting outside going like, no, that's an exaggeration of a number, folks. But that's why there was a meeting of cops who have class 4 body armor going on outside going like, well, yeah, but like we technically don't have to go in there and do that, though, right?
You know, and I wouldn't even mind if the person that's standing out there that is just the extra set of eyes sees something, yells on the radio, holy shit, there's a shooter coming in and all that. That's fine. Yeah. As long as that extra, it could be an extra few seconds. Yeah. It's all is the difference between a child being in the library.
And yes, we would love to hire them from the sheriff's department. Unfortunately, you A, have to have enough sheriffs to do that. B, you
No, I'm,
to,
what I'm talking about is free. Money.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I'm saying is free.
No, that absolutely. I'm responding to somebody in our chat right now. Security gets expensive, and when you're talking sheriffs, things like that, typically that is private security, which is done on overtime.
And a lot of private security is actually just an off-duty officer making 1.5 times what he does as an officer.
Exactly. So, and that's just the realities of the entanglement of that, which is why we need an involved citizenry.
Well, the other unfortunate sad part of the policing issue here is that people here in America look up to police for them to protect and serve. And when somebody goes through a police academy, a sheriff's academy, or whether a federal academy, whatever it's going to be, the modern civilian that does not become a police officer and go through those academies, they look up to a police officer thinking and knowing, you know, that, you know, this police officer is going to run in and save me if I'm in trouble. You know, that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're paid to do.
That is the expectation.
That's why they're paid. That's why they make $200,000 a year, you know, more with overtime. And unfortunately, you know, we can't speculate what the Uvalde Police Department did or didn't until we know the full scope and information of what had happened. But if that is true, that they've made this decision to say, hey, no, we're not going to go in there because I'm afraid of that kid with the long rifle. I'm afraid of that kid with the gun. Then there's no reason for that person to be a police officer.
Right.
Because there is.
And the problem is being able to identify that officer has that issue ahead of time is another issue. So the thing is that over time, and also there's enough, we have enough data points to go back to and look at situations and go, okay, here's the data points that for Sandy Hook, Parkland, now Uvalde and so forth, that these are the areas where we know we had the issue. This needs to be eliminated immediately. The issue of making a decision, that person needs to be fired. Obviously, I think we all realize that when the television interview or the conference was being made, that we saw the writing on the wall. This person's going to have a problem because everyone pointed to this person making the decision that this was a barricade situation. That person made the wrong decision. That person needs to go. Yeah. I'm not saying, you know, necessarily the person needs to be prosecuted criminally or whatever, but whatever process he thought he was using to make the decision to not go in, that process needs to be removed immediately.
So actually what does happen is, you know, and what we're seeing right now is there's a lot of cities and counties with a lot of budget cuts due to the law enforcement after George Floyd. But within what we're seeing too, is that a lot of these police officers are afraid to go do things because they don't want to lose their job.
A true fear of prosecution that is actively stymieing officers in the field.
Yep,
absolutely.
And also with what transpired with these officers and federal agents and everyone that was there after these children were innocently, you know, taken away from the good Lord, right?
Yeah.
Now there is an open channel for a negligent homicide investigation to take place. Now that's up for the district attorney. That is up for the federal prosecutor.
Are you still there?
Yeah. Miguel? I told him to charge his phone.
Oh, no.
He may not. Miguel, just call back.
If that is the case, then yes. Yeah. I'm sure that charges will be levied. I'm sure that prosecution will come about. I hope, as is so often the case, frequently we see that not being the case in the case right. of negligence on behalf
and it,
of
and it varies enforcement. Between yeah, it varies between the states and actually within the states, whether it's a state law enforcement, city law enforcement, county and so forth, sheriff, you know, deputy, police, whatever. Yeah. So what you look at there is that there's different levels of immunity that an officer has. And I agree 100% that that should be in place, that officers should have a certain level of immunity. Otherwise, I wouldn't take the job. I can't be expected to do all these different things. But at the same time, when it becomes a question of negligence, that is the key word, the key identifier that changes the game. It's in every lawsuit, whether it's a malpractice suit or whether it's some sort of whatever the civil suit is, Las Vegas, the mayor is a mass shooter, or someone slips and falls. You have to be able to look at it from a situation of negligence. Was the officer negligent? And that is where it becomes a huge issue at law, because there's so many what in legal terms wobbler, where you go back and forth. You're not really sure if it's this or if it's that, or it could be in the middle. And I get that. But these officers, whether one head should roll or 19 heads should roll, and in 19, I mean by the officers that were, apparently that number was 19 that was in, you know, yeah. in that holding pattern, so to speak. Where does this ball drop? How does it drop? Because the officers are following orders that they were told that this is a very good situation.
They were following a stand-down order.
Exactly. So I understand all that. And this is all, again, Monday quarterbacking and what have you. But there's a fundamental problem that we have on how we handle these types of events. And the same situation can be looked at as what we saw through the riots that we went through. We have a big problem on how to handle where a lot of people are either being shot or a lot of people are the problem. And our system doesn't have enough. I don't want to say we need new laws, all this other stuff, but we need some sort of sweeping task force. And I think I may have told you this privately, but what's being looked at and what I'm wanting to propose, and also which is why I brought Miguel on, is that there needs to be a task force, a small one, that is made up of a very diverse group of individuals with varying backgrounds that go all over the map. I don't mean just a bunch of ex-military or ex-law enforcement or ex-anything. I mean a very well-selected group of people to come in to make some form of actionable change in how we handle these situations, because this could have been a building collapse. It could have been an earthquake. It could, all these different scenarios to where a group of individuals either take advantage of the situation where they go out and riot and loot and do all kinds of things like that, to the other end of the spectrum, to where, you know, we have a situation that involves a single individual perpetrating a crime against many individuals. And these people are alive for 78 minutes? Yeah. No, there needs to be a system in place that addresses that issue. And I get it. You know, that everyone has rights, including the shooter. But at the same time, those rights go out the window once that first shot is shot and you're done. Yeah. That's the end of it.
Yeah. Once you foray the first volley.
Yep.
It's a different story, and that's exactly the case, yep. Mike. Thank you so much.
Game over.
As always, for your time, for coming on, helping break down what is a very sensitive and, once again, fluid situation. Do thank Miguel for his time as well.
I will.
We'll talk to you very soon, my friend.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Chris.
Tell everybody where they can go to keep up with 5x5 News, where they can watch your latest videos. Everything else?
Well, very simply, you can either search for 5x5 News, but I try to keep my most current information on YouTube. I've been laxer lately because of my work in Afghanistan, of which Miguel is very much aware of exactly what I'm doing. He's the one that brought me into it. The situation, if you look for 5x5 News on YouTube. That's where you're going to have your most up-to-date information. Interact with me on any level on Twitter, also by looking for 5x5 News. On Twitter, I'm a little bit more active as far as talking back and forth and things, and but you're limited as to, you know, the scope of what you can talk about. But anyone can reach out to me in any way at MikeTurber@gmail.com or reach out to me through YouTube, Facebook on the 5x5 News page there, or on Twitter, any of the above.
Absolutely. Mike, once again, thank you so much for coming on. Stay tuned, everybody. After this commercial break, we will be talking to Robert Lindsay Milne about what it is to be psychic, how to recognize these natural inborn abilities in yourselves and family members around you, how to curate them and help them grow. We'll be back with that and so much more right after this. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7%. Off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. And welcome back, everybody. In this segment, we will be talking to intuitive psychic Robert Lindsay Milne about the world of the intuitive psychic, what an intuitive psychic is, how does somebody learn to sharpen, hone, or even recognize psychic ability in either themselves, a loved one, a child, things like that. We will be getting into that. Thank you so much to our sponsors, especially our latest sponsors, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. SecretToEverything.com is the website. She is your source for alternative health, frequency healing, and expanded consciousness exercises. Stop on by today. SecretToEverything.com is the website. Also, make sure to stop on by WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is your home for high speed for the whole family. Uninterrupted bandwidth, no credit checks, no throttling. And believe me, when I say no throttling, I'm going to look right at the camera. I put up about 20 gigs of content a month with this show and with other business, things like that. WebWorks Wireless is our exclusive provider for our, you see it right there, our website live streams. Anytime that I am on the road, whatever, I am out benchmarking that for them, and I have yet to be capped or throttled on either side. Stop on by, check them out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. While you're there, make sure to check out RobertLindsayMilne.com. Robert Lindsay Milne is one of the most well-known psychic intuitives in the North American continent. Welcome to the show again. Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm having a great day, and thanks for having me back on. What a different world it is since the last time we talked.
Absolutely, man. It's been really interesting to see the world kind of reboot in the way that it has. Even myself going back out on the road as an AV technician, flying in aluminum tubes with strangers and... was something, you know, you always made the joke about like, oh man, every time I get off a plane, I have a cold from the recycled air, things like that. Now it's like, no, really, I am hopping into a tube with like 150 other people that I do not know what they do.
Right.
It's interesting to be kind of in that heightened state all the time. And especially for someone like you, Robert. Who is a psychic intuitive. A, let's get into what a psychic intuitive is. B, let's get into what that heightened state of the world around us does to someone like you. I mean, I know what it does to me, just as an anxiety sufferer and having to keep my buffers up in the world around me, kind of like a horse with blinders on, is my example. You know, like whenever I go to the airport, I'm focused on my gate. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is just all too much for me. But man, it must be hard for someone like you to actively filter that out and the energy it takes to do that. So let's introduce the audience to the idea of the intuitive psychic real quick.
Well, I use intuitive psychic only because Several years ago, some of the new agers started saying that I was sounding really old fashioned by saying I'm a psychic. So I thought of, well, what else could I call myself? Well, I'm intuitive and I am a psychic. Let's be an intuitive psychic counselor. And that's how I got that title. I sense, I feel, I can see, I often can see people's futures. I often can see people's past. And when I'm doing readings, and I'm often aware of what's going on around me, everywhere I go. And I'm hypersensitive to what happens. Sometimes I have to, withdraw because I certainly at this time in my life, I can be more sensitive or my defenses are not quite as strong. But I do have to make sure that I don't get overwhelmed. Going to a concert can be difficult.
Yes.
In fact, I seldom do. And one of the reasons is there was a group, I think they're still around, it was called Simply Red. And I went to one of their concerts back in the late 80s. And it was at Roy Thomson Hall in Toronto. And it was a beautiful concert, beautiful hall. And the problem was the singer, I guess that was Red, and the keyboard player either hated each other's guts or they were having a fight that night. But the energy between these two guys, while they were playing, it was really negative and they were really angry. And I sensed that. And it ruined, you know, and that energy underneath the beautiful music was ruined for me. Yeah. So I can sense that. I also have to be careful in a crowd. I just get bombarded with so many thoughts. So I do have to be careful. But On the other hand, I have been a psychic, an intuitive, or whatever you want to call it, ever since I've been alive. It's what I am and was born to do.
And, you know, as somebody with a small child, my kid just turned 15, Robert. Yep. Or not 15, 5.
Yeah, right.
Oh, a little bit of a difference.
Even
at 15, though. Sure. But how did your parents deal with having a child of ability? Did they recognize that they had a child of ability?
No. In fact, the contrary. My father, he just died a year ago, August, or a year ago, this August. Thank you. He was 92. So he had a great life, and he stopped working when the pandemic hit. He worked full time right up until he was 91. So, he told me throughout my life that he would believe that his son, his only son, was a fraud and a charlatan. He also, you know, said a few times I was the only guy he ever met that never had a job. And so he really rejected it. Wow. My mother did for a while. My sisters started accepting it, but mostly in my family in the early days it was rejected. I'll give you an example. And part of it wasn't so much that they blatantly rejected it. They just didn't understand or know about it.
Sure.
So the first remembrance I have, I came home from school, same age as your boy is now. I was about 5 or 6. I was either in grade one or kindergarten. So I came home from school. Now, that was about 1955. So it was a very different world. And I came home from school for lunch and I said to my mother, Grandma Harris died today. Grandma Harris was my great grandmother who lived in England, not in Canada.
Oh, wow.
And I'd only seen her once in my life. So I come home, tell my mother, Grandma Harris died. My mother got angry with me and said, and yelled at me for saying bad things. Might have even hit me for it. Okay. So now we flip forward the next night at dinner. My sister, myself, my dad, my mother having dinner. My mother says to my father, Grandma Harris died yesterday. Now, in those days, people didn't, a lot of people didn't have phones. And in those days, you didn't make long distance calls. So news traveled across the Atlantic very slowly. So she heard it after I told her. She said, Grandma Harris died yesterday. I thought my father was going to get angry with my mother for saying bad things. And to my astonishment, they talked about it. And nobody got mad, and they talked about it. And over my lifetime, in those early days, I used to say things, and I would get into trouble. You know, Uncle Harold, that wasn't Aunt Sally. Who was that person? Well, I did, and I got hit for that. Now, I didn't understand that he was doing something wrong. Mm. I just was seeing. So, I would sense energies and. It was just the way I am and have been. And I've always been empathic and I feel and I'm sensitive towards other people, especially when they're having difficulty. And even as a child, I was giving aid and help to people. And it's just an instinct. And I've done that as long as I've been alive.
Yeah, and that is the story that I hear more often than not, is that it was something that was just there. Developed, you know, much like any other skill, much like any child with aptitude toward music.
Absolutely.
Mine was electronics.
Yes.
Don't know why it was, but
that's right.
I was just drawn toward it. And earlier when you were talking about being at a rock concert, I could appreciate what you were talking about, because that is where my example that I give to people for my horse blinders comes from.
Sure.
Because for years I mixed rock and roll live in clubs, 3-4 sure. bands a night.
Wow.
For me to go into a bar and enjoy a show anymore is very hard because of the muddled energy in the room.
Sure.
If I am behind the soundboard, my focus is on the energy on the stage, nothing right. more.
Of course.
And what's going on there. So yeah, it's interesting to be able to focus past it, but still have the noise that's going on. And how did you learn to filter that out, especially as a child? Because it's wearing enough as a grown folk. And like you said, gotten a little bit harder as you have gotten on in career. But how did you deal with that as a child?
It wasn't until I was around 9 years old that I actually understood what I was doing. And it happened in a rather grandiose way. My father, took me to a Stanley Cup hockey game, and it was a semifinal, Toronto and Boston. And it was like 1958. And, the game went into overtime, and the score was 1-1. And incidentally, the series was tied 1-1. And when the fourth period started, I became very drawn to number 17 with Toronto. His name was Gary Eamon. And the game hadn't started. The guys were just kind of stretching, for the fourth period to start. Anyway, the referee blows a whistle, and the teams, most players leave the ice, and the first line is on. And Gary Eamon wasn't even on the first line. He was on the bench. So the game's just about to start. Imagine Maple Leaf Gardens, there are 18,000 people there. The lights go down, and the bright lights, the only lights are on that are on at the ice, and the entire building is silent. And as the referee is about to drop the puck, I knew number 17 was going to score. And it was so powerful that he was going to score, even though he wasn't even on the ice. It felt like he had already scored. Wow. And I jumped up and started yelling and screaming and cheering in this silent building of 18,000 people, and everyone turned and looked at me and my dad. And my dad put my his hand on my shoulder and he said, sit down. Referee drops the puck, you know, the plays for a little bit, maybe 5 minutes or so. Eamon jumps over the board, a guy named Red Kelly passes the puck, and Eamon tips the puck into the net for the overtime goal, wins the game. And the entire building erupted. And I looked around the building and I realized then that nobody knew Eamon was going to score. And that's when I knew. I saw things differently. That wasn't as sophisticated, but I knew then that I was different. And I saw things that other people didn't. And to a degree, that was a saving, Grace. There's been a few.
Well, and, you know, with that in mind, especially I'd like to rewind things to your father's disapproval. There are a lot of people, Robert, who see even people with the gift that you have and the way in which you use it, because it's not like you're out divining the future for people. You know, you aren't going out and like playing Quantum Leap, and changing people's futures. You aren't going out and doing anything like that. You aren't misusing your gift in that way.
Okay.
What was the old school show? I think it was called Tomorrow's News.
Okay.
I don't do that.
I see myself as a professional. I run my practice like a professional.
Yeah.
Even online, when I do, online or video readings, I am dressed exactly the way I would be in my office doing readings. And I behave that way. I am a professional and I work my craft as a professional and I'm very dedicated to it. And I see it as I see one-on-one psychic work as healing, as teaching, and yes, of course, talking about the future, but also showing people how they can make things happen and what will be happening. So, and also what has gone on in their life. And when I do readings, I most often now see people's lives from conception to completion. And, now I mostly focus in the middle parts of their life or where they are, but I do see the, both ends. Now, I've also, last January, I celebrated 57 years of being a professional psychic.
Wow.
I was 15 and a half years old when I started working at the Cozy Tea Room in Toronto, and I started there full time. And it was the way I got off. I was homeless during that time, 14 and a half and 15. And I survived by my psychic ability and on the streets. And I heard that if you worked at the Cozy Tea Room as a reader, you would get a sandwich and a cup of tea and cookies. And if you did readings, you would get paid at the end of the shift. And if you worked in the evening, you'd get a hot dinner and cookies and a cup of tea and you'd get, and I applied for the job and then I did a reading for the owner and I had to do a tea leaf and card reading. Never did tea leaf reading, never did card readings before. So I just looked at the tea leaves and I looked at Mrs. Cox and I looked at her and just did a regular psychic reading for her. And then I put the cards down. I had no idea what they meant, but I pretended I did. But what I was doing, I did a psychic reading for her and she hired me. And that day I got a sandwich and a cup of tea and I got a hot dinner and I got paid for two shifts. And that night I had a place to sleep. Wow. And the next day I had a place to go to work. And I started working at the Cozy Tea Room and I worked there 5 days a week, 6 days a week, sometimes even 7 days a week till I was about 21.
Wow.
And it's been I honed my psychic abilities on the street.
And how do you respond to those who would say that what you do or what psychics do is in the realm of I guess, quote, evil or the dark side. Yeah, I've never really understood that concept, but I know people who actively think so.
Okay.
Who would call, I guess, even mediumship more akin to necromancy than mediumship. And okay. Really pull a hard line on that.
Okay.
How do you respond to that?
Like I'm doing right now.
And that's what I love.
Well, so here's the thing.
It really is a point of misunderstanding.
Well, here's the thing. It is impossible to describe the color yellow to somebody who has been blind since birth. So how can you expect somebody who and somebody who is not evolving in their brain yet to acknowledge what's going on? So you can't. Okay, you can't win an argument like that. Don't even bother.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And the example that I have been giving people lately is takes a lot of pennies to make a dollar. Sure. Some of them are shiny. Some of them are dull. They're all worth a penny.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, for me is that I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, and the reason for that is because it's not whatever else someone else is perceiving is their stuff. I focus on mine.
Yes.
And I'm not interested in being a savior in converting anybody. What I'm interested in is giving service in the moment. So I've done more than 100,000 psychic connections in my career. It's, you know, it's pretty impressive. But I do more than psychic readings, and my life also is one of, and I don't quite have a label for it, but, 20 times a year, I'm in a situation where I'm directly involved in helping someone survive or not get killed or not die. It happened the other night again, where I was in the right place at the right time, and somebody was close to dying, and I helped them not die. So here's how this happened. Your listeners might find this interesting. So I've just recently moved, and I'm in a whole brand new neighborhood. And Friday night I went out for a walk, and I live in Toronto at St. Clair and Dufferin, and I wanted to sample some of the fancy food. And I take it out, you know, for takeout, and I just couldn't find the right restaurant. I walked up and down the street and went on and on, and I just said, oh, the heck with it. I'm not going to find anything fancy or that draws my attention. So I went to a chicken store. I bought some chicken and I started on my way home. And going on my way home, I would have been walking, and I was to, in my mind, walking south on the east side. And I'm walking home, and all of a sudden I look down, and there are people have been walking by this spot. And there is this guy laying on the ground, all spread out, eyes back, rolling back in his head, and he's gurgling, but he's breathing. And I stop, I look for a moment, and I go up to the guy, and you know, I say, are you okay? Anyway, long story short is that he was unconscious, and I was trying to figure out what I should do. Right beside me, a woman came up with white hair, short white hair, but I was mostly focused on the man. And she whispered or spoke to me, and she said, his air passage is constricted. His mouth is closed. He's breathing through his nose, and he's she said that. No, that's what she said to me. And then I dialed 911, and the 911 operator said the same thing to me and then started guiding me to help the guy.
Wow.
And once again, the woman beside me was telling me the same thing that the operator was. Anyway, a few minutes later, the paramedics came and they revived the guy. He had had a fentanyl overdose.
Wow.
Now, here's the thing, though. when I walked away, when the paramedics came and I was walking down the street, I didn't recognize anything. And I realized that I was actually walking north and not south. And I was on the east side of the street. And I don't know how that happened. So I turned around, walked back. As I was walking past them again, the paramedic called me, and the guy on the ground, they told me that he had a fentanyl attack, and but he was conscious and he would be okay. When I started walking home, I realized that, or I thought that he was very close to the, you know, the main street. And the next day when I went out, he actually was about 150 yards away from the main street. I don't know how I got on the other side of the street.
Wow.
I don't know why it happened, except that I followed my instincts. I just did it. And those things happen around me all the time.
And do you think it is because you are open to the occasion of them happening?
Yes.
And I think that that's an important thing to note. Is that you are open to the fact of them happening.
I like to do it.
Sure.
I don't think about it a lot. It's like it wasn't until like the next day that I thought, you know, hey, you just saved that guy's life. I usually don't think about it. They happen often. And later I do, but not in the moment.
At what point in life was there ever a point where this gift to you was a burden? I know there was definitely a point in my life where it seemed like people were becoming projects to me. It led me down a dark road, let's just say, in my life of addiction and trying to silence emotion and feeling other people. Not healthy things. Was there ever a time for you that this gift was a burden and that you wanted to shed it?
I don't see this as what I have as a gift. I see it as an ability, but it's not a gift. The reason that I do my work as well as I do is because I'm dedicated, I'm committed. I've spent my life doing it. And when I say dedicated, when I worked at the tea room, I worked full time. And I said, you know, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week. At about 21, when I left the tea room, I had heard that when a young man becomes a priest, he makes a vow to say a mass every day of his life. Mm. And I was realizing that what I was doing in terms of readings and giving service, I knew that this is what I was going to do for my life. So I decided that I would either do a psychic reading or practice being psychic every day. And I did that without missing a day for a little over 30 years. So I practice every day, or I do readings every day. And I'm very disciplined in that. And I practice and I practice and I practice and I practice. That's one of the reasons that I've been accomplished the way I have.
And I mean, of course, we've had more than one psychic, more than one intuitive, more than one medium, and as they all say, it is something.
There are others, are there?
There's a couple.
Really? Eh? Okay.
but they all say the same thing as you. It's not a gift. It's something off. that much like if you have legs, you can more than likely run.
Right.
I just might be able to run a little bit faster than you naturally.
That's right.
But with work, with diligence, right. You can run just as fast as me, if not faster.
That's exactly right. And that is exactly right. And this has been, I have been dedicated to this service. it's the purpose of my life. I knew that at a young age. And in many ways, I've sacrificed to do this. But it wasn't a sacrifice, and there isn't a sacrifice.
Yeah, because it's for you, like you said, it's not a gift, which could become a burden. It's an actual vocation.
That's right.
It is what moves you to be.
It's a way of being. I do live I have always worked since the tea room. I've always just worked for myself and found my own path.
Now, of course, that is important on so many psychological levels, to be founded in yourself and to be happy within yourself. I mean, whether you're trying to practice your straight law of attraction in the universe, trying to attract a mate, what have you. But when it comes to ability, honing ability, things like that, how important is it to accept yourself where you're at and as you are, and to literally just be? Like you said earlier, not to be concerned about people's judgment about you, but to be comfortable in your own skin and to just be.
Well, when I was much younger, I certainly wasn't as much indifferent when somebody would say that I was evil or I was doing the devil's work or a fraud. It took me a pretty long time to get a thick skin. Or also, it took me a pretty long time to see why they were seeing it that way. And so that's an important thing to know. You know, the way I am now at 72 or almost 73, and the way I was at 23 is quite different, and certainly a lot more polished and experienced and aware. And it's a life's journey. You asked if has there ever been a time that I being psychic was a drawback. I can't think of any time that it has been a drawback or that I wished I didn't have it. It's never been a hindrance. In fact, to the opposite.
Wow. And, you know, once again, that is such an entire blessing to know for you that you have always been comfortable with it and comfortable in your own skin about it. Because like you said earlier, a lot of families do not understand. They do not. I mean, even my young son, he has a friend Mouse that he talks to. I ask what Mouse talks to him about.
Yes,
I don't discredit Mouse. I'm more interested in what Mouse has to say.
Oh yeah. What does Mouse say?
Well, you know, on occasion Mouse has, you know, talked him into a situation or two, like dropping the toothpaste cap down the sink to see what happened. Mouse wanted to know what happened. So, okay. So what did you learn? What did Mouse learn about that?
That's great.
But it's one of those, I'm not going to preclude that fact. I have had my own ecstatic experiences in the world. I can't deny that. So yeah, for me, it's one of those, where my son to come to me and say these things, I would have people, fortunately, I would have people like you to be able to send him to, Robert. and let's get into that real quick. Like, sure. Because a lot of these things do manifest in younger children, and they're there, and then they're kind of, once again, suppressed by parents, because there is an expectation of normalcy, quote, in the world around us. And how important is it to listen to what children are saying with literally the heart and mind of a child, like with that point of innocence, as they would say in the Bible, you know, with that open heart.
I don't think being psychic, I would think that if you raise a child and you're kind and loving and gentle and caring and supportive, would be the way to raise them, whether they were prone to being an athlete, a musician, a mathematician, a philosopher. I think that would just be the way to raise a child myself. That's how I would think about it.
Well, what things should parents be on the lookout for from children who may be a bit more running down that vein as they grow up, you know, because of course there's Mouse and he may grow out of Mouse. Who knows? I'm not going to discourage anything like that, but what are some things that parents, parents should keep an eye out for?
I've never thought of that. I've never considered that. That's why I gave you that, you know, flimsy answer just a little while ago. I've never considered it.
Because we're definitely coming to a point in our human society where the work of people like Caroline Corey, the work of people like you are getting out there more in the mainstream, and people are starting to realize that, yeah, when it comes to these strange attractions, when it comes to these things, it's no less than a point of quantum physics. It's no less than a point of, even though you're in far North America and beyond a border, Robert, like, well, we are sharing an electron shell right now.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed in the last while, throughout my career, almost everyone that does psychic work has experienced serious trauma in our lives. And often in the early stages, most of us have had really hard lives and have been through a lot. And I jokingly say that, you know, psychics don't come down from heaven. We fight our way out of hell, and work our way up. So most of us have been deeply traumatized, had terrible things happen to us. And it's in those types of experiences that causes our basic instincts to become sharpened.
Well, and even like you were saying earlier, we spent quite a bit of time in our last interview, I recall, discussing how your ability actively helped you survive on the street. Actively helped you know who was safe, who wasn't, where to go
for food.
Yeah.
How to get it. I never begged. I never robbed anybody, never stole anything. I always just survived by being in the right place at the right time. Being willing to work for it, and give service. And I was always helping, much older people, and, you know, and often would give them my food and, you know, things like that, even as a kid on the street.
Well, and, you know, just once again, considering the modern world that we live in and the acceptance that we have toward the paranormal, toward even things like UFOs, UAPs, witness sightings, there's a much more open mind out there. There's a great realm of near-death research going on, all kinds of things. What can people do in their life to better sharpen this natural reflex that they have?
That's a great question.
You know,
I have the answer.
Because I mean, of course, I think it all kind of starts with discernment, but let's go into what we can do as average people to help our ability.
I can answer that question. Okay. So I used to teach a class, I'm going to be doing it again in the future, but I used to teach a class, a one-day seminar on how to be psychic. And I would guarantee that anybody that would sit in my one-day seminar and they go through the, you know, they do what I show them, I guarantee them that they will do a psychic reading for a stranger before that class is over. And if you don't, you get your money back. No questions asked. And I taught that for about 25 or 30 years. And there was only been three times that I gave money back or that people asked for their money back. And here's what I start off with saying. Become aware of what's obvious. Look at the person in front of you and become aware of what's obvious. When you become aware of what's obvious, then more becomes obvious about that person. And when more becomes obvious, then even more becomes obvious again. Until your awareness becomes so broad that what is obvious to you is not obvious to other people. So let me give you an example outside of the psychic realm, how this works. There was a time where I lived in a small town just outside of Toronto doing the small town thing and the 120 mile round trip commute to this big city. In this small town, I wasn't very good at working with my hands, and the only thing I could do was paint, like in the inside of houses. And in that house, I used to paint so much that I painted that house five times from top to bottom in 5 years, because that's all I could do. A friend of mine who is a contractor came in one day, and I was really proud of my painting, and he walked in and looked around and he said, "Robert, who the hell did your paint job?" You know? And I said, "I did. It was me." And he said, okay. So I guess it's not bad. And I said to him, "Hugh, what are you seeing what are you seeing?"
Yep.
And what he did is he started pointing out to me the mistakes and the errors I made. And I never unsaw them. Not only did I never unsee them, I started, when I go into a place, I see the mistakes.
It's the first thing you see now.
Because it's obvious.
Yeah.
When you become aware of what's obvious, then more becomes obvious again. And then again and again, and it continues. So to the next level, and a big part of my career, I was the first Canadian psychic to appear on radio and TV shows and to travel, to tour across the world. I was the first one to do that in Canada. And when I would be doing shows, I would always listen to the air checks that I would do. But when I would be talking to the caller, and the way it would work, people call up, give me their first name, tell me where they're calling from, have a question on their mind, don't ask it. So I'd say, "Hi, Mary, thanks a lot for calling." And then I would just start talking about them. When I was doing that on the air and when I was focused, I was saying to myself, "Robert, what you're saying to this person is so bloody obvious, you're going to get caught." And I'd be saying things like, "Okay, so you're sitting in the pink chair in the living room that you had an argument with your husband in. Is that right?" You know, and I'm thinking to myself, "Anybody can see that, Robert. You're going to be in trouble. They're going to catch you." So that's what was going through my mind when I'm looking at that. When I listen to the air check, the next day, I'm in a totally different frame of mind. But I can remember what I was thinking about when I was doing that. And when I'm listening, I go, "Whoa, there's nothing obvious about that at all."
Yeah.
That's not. And I go, "Oh, okay." So when you become aware of what's obvious and look at the person in front of you, look at them, see them, no judgment, just see them. Yeah. Then you will see more and more and more. And that's how you start off.
That is a really beautifully simplistic way to put it.
It is simple, though.
Because it's hard to look at something or even a situation or a person without a preconceived notion.
Well,
it's a pointed exercise to get to in life, most definitely.
Well, the thing is with that is you can use it in any situation. Become aware of what's obvious, then more becomes obvious, and it is growth. It's how we grow, and it's how we become aware.
Yeah. I mean, that is a great and simple pathway to that.
Now, on the other hand, when instead of saying, oh, become aware of what's obvious, then more becomes obvious, then you could say to the person, oh, well, get in touch with your medium skills, get in touch with your empathic ability, get in touch with your clairvoyant ability, get in touch with your whatever. And then all of a sudden the person is trying to do something that they're analyzing rather than just being.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get in trouble. When you write a book and tell people how to be psychic, what you got to put a lot of words in and you got to give them a lot of information. And being psychic isn't about getting energy in your analytical brain. Getting psychic is tuning in, getting in touch with your inner self and expressing that in this simple way. And that's how you do it. When you get really good at doing it that way, then put labels on it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Perfectly said. Because it's hard for people outside to understand what you're talking about. I'm sure quite a bit of the time. And like you said, it's hard for you to say things sometimes without people having a sense of disbelief.
Oh, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
Even if I'm doing a reading, I don't care. Well, if the person's really, you know, disbelieving, I'll stop the reading, but, sure. I don't care. About that, I'm not responsible for the person's beliefs. I'm responsible to give that person the best information that I can give them in the best way that I know how, and being able to relate to that individual the best way I know how. Sometimes I can't. I give them their money back. Most times I can't. But there are times that I can't. And as I'm getting older, I'm getting better, but there are more times that I'm not able to than I used to be. But that also might be because I'm more fussy on what I'm doing. That may be the case too.
Well, you know, I remember my spiritual director. I'm sure that it's especially if you, because a lot of what you're doing is very much spiritual direction, especially if you have repeat people coming to you, things like that. And, that's literally the first time that I ever heard the phrase, how's that working out for you?
Right.
Was from my Dominican, monk who was, really? who was my spiritual director. Like, okay, so how's that working out for you? Because we've talked about this like three or four times now.
Sure.
So now that you've like beaten the dead horse, what have you learned? and yeah, it must be a very hard for you not to have that attitude and to have a loving attitude to begin with. But we have you for a few more minutes. And one of the things that we have, I guess, kind of focused on over the last few episodes is the negative side of these things, whether they be a paranormal experience and coming forth with it, whether it's a near-death experience, and people who back without having the rosy-cheeked experience.
Are you talking about getting readings or just living your life?
Well, I mean, getting messages, because I guess getting messages that you are supposed to give to other people.
There's no such thing as a message I'm supposed to give.
Okay.
There is a message that is important and I'll choose to allow it and give it. but I don't have to.
Okay.
And anything I do from my heart and I love. I nobody tells me that I have to.
Okay.
I won't do it. But I will do it if it's needed and I'm able to do it. The negative side, sometimes you can get hurt, unexpectedly. I've been hurt a few times. Mm-hmm. I was in South Africa. That's a long story. That'll take up the whole. Anyway, it was a situation where, what I have taught my students is that when the energy is coming through you, it won't hurt you as long as you bring the energy through you and you release it. If you keep the energy inside, that's when it will affect you, because what's coming through you is not for you. So when you have that energy inside you, that will make you sick. There have been times where I've been in a situation where giving somebody some information would upset them so much, I chose not to give it. Oh. And I got sick. A woman whose child had been kidnapped. Oh. and had been brutally murdered and butchered. I was on a live TV show, and she stood up and she asked me the question live to air. And she said to me that her daughter was missing, and what could I help her with it? And I saw what happened. And there was no way in the world that I was going to tell that woman that information
at that moment. Yeah.
And I held it inside, and I was sick for a pretty long time. And in fact, it interfered with the South African tour. We stopped it early, and I left and then came back 6 months later and finished the tour.
Well, and that was my curiosity, you know, was because, of course, like you were saying, it's not necessarily that you are compelled to give a message or that you are forced to give a message, but.
Made a conscious choice when I was there with her, knowing that it would hurt me rather than.
Oh, absolutely.
I knew it, and I knew what I was doing when I did it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. Did you ever have a chance to give her that message?
Oh, I spoke to her later.
Yeah. And that's
and
just
I gave it.
It
very, I gave it to her very, very differently. Yeah. But yes, indeed I did.
Yeah. And there's no way that you can deliver that message in any way, shape or form in live TV. It would not come across in a loving way.
I just wouldn't have done it. I just won't. When I'm doing readings, now remember, I've been doing this my whole lifetime, so I'm constantly evolving. And when I'm doing readings, I see people's lives from beginning to end. I talk about, where they are mostly in this time period, but I am reflecting and going forward and backwards and in time throughout their, reading. And one of the ways that I give people information is I when I'm thinking about something isn't necessarily what I'm saying when I'm doing a reading. Sometimes what I'm thinking about, sometimes what I'm saying has already been processed, and what I'm thinking about is different. And there'll be times where I'll see a person in a situation that's really uncomfortable right now today. And what I'll do is I'll look 40 years into the future, say they're 27 now, and I'll look at them when they're 75 years old, and I'll look back from their vantage point when they're 75, I look backwards in time, and I describe to them today how they feel about the way they handled the problem. And today, how they feel about it when they're old, the way they solved the problem. And then the person starts to grow right away because they now know that they solve it. And then I tell them how they did it. And so by going forward, and then coming back. And then when I'm going to give bad news, I'll talk about the incredibly positive thing that will happen because of the negative event. I focus on that. And then I come back to the present and I just drop a little hint. And then I talk about some other stuff. And then I give a bigger hint. And then, and I might take 20 minutes.
Sure.
To get to that moment. But by the time I give them the bad news, they're ready to take on anything because they know they're going to solve it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say building that trust first.
Right.
And
letting them know that they'll survive it.
Yeah. Yeah. As any good therapist would do. And that's just it.
I like that. I like being called a good therapist. If I were just a therapist, I would consider myself really successful. Therapists are very valuable and good people.
Yeah. Well, and yours is therapy just in a different way.
That's correct. I agree.
And, you know, it really does take that open heart and that open mind to be able to approach people spiritually in this way, Robert. So,
yes. Thank you.
Blessings to you for the work that you do and that you have done for your entire life, because
thank you.
It's not easy. It's not easy to answer that vocation. And as you've said a couple times, most people who do such things wear collars.
We have doing this type of work. And it's not singular just for me. Most people that I've met that do this kind of work, we're wired a little differently. Our instinct in situations is what can we do rather than what can we get?
Yeah.
And what can go wrong with that? But yes, that's the hard wiring.
Well, and it really is that aspect of, a lot of people, I think, get overwhelmed whenever you say, like, what can we do? Oh, my God, I got no time to do anything. If you can find 1 hour a week, one hour a week to walk around.
Excuse me. If you can see somebody that looks sad and smile at them and say hello.
Yep.
You've just made the time.
Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't have to be something huge. It could be
absolutely not
the smallest moment in the day that means the biggest thing to somebody else.
I agree for sure.
And it is once again that open heart and that open mind to the situation. And I'm so glad that there are people like you out there, Robert. Where can people go? We've of course been showing your website. How can they get a hold of you?
You can
to book
contact
a reading to get instruction to help others, things like that.
You can find me on my website, www.robertlindsaymilne.com. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and you can find my podcast, My Side of the Crystal Ball, pretty much anywhere podcasts are shown. And that's how you get in touch with me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, most definitely. We love having you on. We want to have you on again and again. It's always a great conversation. And it really is about I remember last time we had you on, it was still the middle of COVID. And it was all about keeping your energy up and keeping positive. And it really is about finding, even in your own life, folks, that one moment in every day, I guarantee you, no matter how bad anything gets, there is one moment in every day that was beautiful and made just for you. Keep your eye out for it. Robert, thank you so much once again for coming on. Can't wait to have you on again and again. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online checking out all the great work of Robert Lindsay Milne, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is the website. You can find all of our sponsors there. You can visit the Knowledge Vault, find all kinds of, you know, declassified government documents. You can find links to the recent UFO UAP panel that happened. There is the 24/7 link where you can get random episodes. Stop on by, check it out. CuriousRealm.com. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in, folks. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.